Marie Curie, certainly one of the most famous women in the history of science. She coined the term radioactivity. She was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, the first person to win a Nobel Prize twice, and the only person to win a Nobel Prize in two scientific fields. Not bad. She is a shining example of perseverance and of brilliance. Hello, welcome to Patented. It's a podcast all about the history of invention from History Hit with me, Dallas Campbell. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome back to the series Patricia Farah, one of our great science writers, of whom I am a massive fan. She's the Emeritus Fellow at Clare College at the University of Cambridge. And she's joining me to discuss the spellbinding life of Marie Curie, to talk about her discovery of radium and polonium and her overall contribution to science. Well, welcome back to the show.
We should just get you on every week and just, you can have your own segment.
I kind of want to start with this one because I'm sure I pronounce her name wrong. I always say Marie Curie, but that can't be right, can it?
I think in French it would be Marie Curie, but that's difficult to say in the middle of an English sentence. But in addition, that's not how she would have referred to herself. Most of the time when she was in France, she made a great point of including her Polish name. And I can't pronounce the Polish name, so apologies to any Poles who are listening. But she would be Marie Stadowska-Curie.
I think that's pretty good. I was on YouTube doing one of those how do you pronounce names things, and I think how you just did it was pretty much it. Because I got the fear. I was like, oh, God. But she's where do we start talking about her? Because she's one of these people that has just entered the realm of myth and legend. And so I never quite know what's true and what's not true. And she sort of touches lots of bases. People sort of latch onto different things about her life and sort of read into whatever their own thoughts about her are.
I think that's true, but I think also the way that she's regarded has changed over time. So when I was at school and at university, I was taught to admire her as a great scientist, but I was also taught to admire her as someone who was a martyr to her science, who starved herself, who wasn't interested in her clothes, who just worked 24/7, always looked terribly lonely and miserable. And I always thought that that was rather a strange role model, because I was studying physics, and why on earth would I want to pursue a life where I ended up as miserable as Marie Curie?
You were a rock and roll.
Oh yeah, I was a leftover hippie.
Yeah, well.
But now, when I think it's interesting how that's changed, because if you look up Marie Curie, if you feed it into Google, the first entry you get, long before you get to her, is the cancer charity, which was set up 5 years before she was born. And when I ask my students who Marie Curie is, some of them know, but that she was a scientist, but some of them only associate her with the daffodil and the cancer charity. And of course, a charity for people who are sick is another stereotype of being a woman. It's to do with caring and loving and nurturing. So just going into Google, there's two stereotypes there immediately, and there were various others during her life as well.
Let's start with her as a child. Let's start there, actually. Where are we? Where was she born? And tell me about her very early life.
She was born in Warsaw in Poland, and she was the youngest of five children. And her parents were both very well educated. They were both school teachers, but she was brought up in great poverty because both her parents were politically active. They'd given away all their money to support the political cause. Poland at the time was occupied by the Russians, and so when she went to school, she had to speak in Russian, and Polish was banned. But when she went home, she spoke Polish with her parents. So even to speak her own language was a political activity. And she was very clever. She worked very hard at school. Then when she left, she wasn't allowed to go to university in Poland because she was a woman. So she and her sister joined an organisation called the Floating University, which was a sort of radical group.
An underground
yes.
thing. I always thought it was the Flying University, but I prefer the Floating University.
But it is flying.
No, but it could probably be either. But actually, the Floating University sounds really good. It sounds really kind of ethereal and.
I mean, it's a translation from the Polish, so it doesn't matter what you call it. In the way. I mean, the whole point... So it was a sort of university without an institution. It was an underground organisation. I don't know if an underground organisation can fly or float, but anyway,
yeah,
there it was. So, I mean, her education was very much from that sort of radical political background, very hostile to the Russians that were occupying the territory.
Wait, Russians occupying? This sounds terribly familiar.
The Russians occupied Poland, and that was why she wasn't allowed to speak Polish at school. She had to speak Russian at school.
And what, I mean, did women go to university then, or particularly to do science? Presumably not.
Well, France was one of the very few countries that did accept women in university, and that's why Marie Curie was not alone. A fair number of women from the Eastern European countries went to Paris to study because they couldn't study in their own countries. So all the sort of, well, all the scientists and mathematicians who were women, obviously there's not huge numbers of them, but they studied in Paris. So when she went to Paris, the sort of famous story that she was living up on the sixth floor and starving in a garret and didn't have enough food to eat, she wasn't alone in that. There was a large community of voluntary exiled Eastern Europeans who were living in Paris and studying, both men and women. Mm.
And just, I mean, her mind, her father was a physicist. Is that where she got her love of science from? I mean, what was her sort of intellectual drivers?
Well, I think she was a very, very determined woman. And she was, I mean, who can say where somebody's intelligence come from? She was certainly taught maths and physics by both her parents. Both her parents were very well-educated school teachers. So she came from a very intellectual background. And she just became fascinated by physics. She already, by the time she started her work on radioactivity, she already had a couple of degrees from Paris. She did a PhD on magnetism in steel. So she was a very, very gifted theoretical physicist. Although when she and Pierre were working on radioactivity, she also ended up doing a huge amount of practical work as well, hard physical labour in the laboratory.
So here we are. She's in Paris studying. She's starving in a garret. And there's all those, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on, all those stories of her sort of not eating properly and wearing sort of dowdy clothes. Is that sort of accurate?
Oh, I believe it is accurate, but I mean, a lot of people were in that position. And I think it's wrong just to focus absolutely on that. I mean, it makes the whole story so romantic to imagine her starving in a garret, but
yeah.
Her sister was there. Her sister was looking after her. I mean, she did have enough money, and she was hard up, but so were a lot of other students, extremely hard up.
Yeah.
And the work that she did in the laboratory when she and Pierre spent 2 years sifting through uranium salts in order to extract the radium chloride that was radioactive. That was extremely, extremely hard physical labour done under very arduous conditions. Like, they didn't have a nice research laboratory like they'd be provided with now. It was a very, very hard life. But I think it's a shame to focus just on that, to focus on the deprivation and the misery.
I think you're right, though. Do you think why her story is so enduring is that romantic starving in a Paris garret. I mean, we talk about artists starving in Paris garrets, and you know, if she was rich with rich patrons, it probably wouldn't have the same ring to it.
Absolutely not. And it's an interesting comparison, I think, would be Rosalind Franklin here, who's only remembered because she was a victim of male oppression by Crick and Watson. She's not remembered at all for the pioneering work she did on viruses. And then as another English example, Dorothy Hodgkin, who's the only British woman to have won a Nobel Prize. And she was phenomenally clever, phenomenally hardworking, really important scientist, and yet very few people in this country have heard of her because she hasn't got a nice romantic story to decorate her life. And I think that sort of problem is far more acute for women than for men. I think it's worse for scientists and for artists because most people can't understand the science. And so they go for a nice sub-story instead.
That's a really interesting point. And, you know, the area of science that she's known for is really, really difficult. It's really, really difficult to understand. I mean, you mentioned she started off, her early work was on magnetism. Magnetism is really difficult to understand. And then suddenly we get the shift from magnetism through to this new, almost magical, the magical properties of radiation. What she discovered was pretty fundamental and hadn't, I mean, the fact that sort of the way that radioactivity works, understanding the sort of inside of an atom, we kind of take for granted now. But she was fundamental in understanding that, wasn't she? That she wasn't just, you know, it was like hardcore physics.
Oh, well, she was in there right at the beginning. She invented the word radioactivity. She suggested, against great opposition, that atoms weren't impenetrable, that radioactivity was due to something taking place inside an atom.
Yeah.
She started her work almost immediately after X-rays and what we now call radioactivity had been discovered. And I think it's quite often the case that women end up going into a subject that nobody else was interested in. This was not mainstream physics when she started it. This was a sort of really curious little sideline that some people had discovered. And she insisted on going into it and studying it. And I think quite a lot of women start out like that because the main areas are sort of roped off, that they're already being researched into. And she insisted on doing it. And her husband, Pierre, kept saying, no, you should be doing what I'm doing. And eventually he realized that she was right and that she was doing something far more interesting than magnetism, which is what he was doing. And he switched and came onto her research project.
I mean, that idea of radioactivity at the time, we take it for granted now, I don't understand radioactivity really. But it kind of must have seemed almost magical at the time, the fact that you'd have these strange elements, the kind of uranium salts that would make strange pictures on photographic plates and X-rays that could see through solid matter. I mean, that must have been pretty magical at the time, the fact that nobody was really investigating it properly.
I think it did seem magical. The fact that the rays are called X-rays is in itself an indication of how mysterious it was. Nobody had any idea what they were. And they were just called rays. And it was Marie Curie who showed that why it is that radioactivity happens. She showed that it comes down for breakdowns of nuclei right deep inside the atom. She coined the word. And so she founded the whole science of radioactivity. And she started her work on radioactivity before Einstein introduced relativity. She was working right at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century.
I think a lot of people, when they hear the name Marie Curie, they sort of slightly grasp for, oh, didn't she invent X-rays, or didn't she invent this, that, or the other? Her science story really starts with the recent discovery of X-rays, doesn't it?
In the middle of the 1890s, within a couple of years, there were two great discoveries. One was by a man called Röntgen, and that was of X-rays. And it really hit the public attention when he published a now famous photograph of his own wife. And you could see the bones of her hand, and then the sort of shadows of her fingers, and a wedding ring floating rather eerily, looking as though it's suspended in space. So that was the first X-ray, when Röntgen went inside his wife's hand, very spectacular photograph. The following year, a French man called Henri Becquerel discovered that uranium salts emanate some sort of strange, mysterious ray. Again, nobody knew what it was. He wrapped up some salts in a little packet of black paper. He left them on the windowsill. There was an iron cross on top of the salts. And then when he unwrapped the photographic plate, the pattern of the cross appeared on the plate as though there'd been a photograph with light, but there hadn't been any light. It was the rays from the uranium that were causing the pattern. And these were the two mysterious phenomena that Marie Curie was determined to investigate.
What was it, do you think, about that really drew her into moving from what she was doing to investigating this further?
Two reasons. One was it was obviously fundamentally important and very, very mysterious. And secondly, I imagine she was attracted by the absence of other people working in that field. This was something that she could go in to right from the very beginning, nobody else trying to oppose her ideas. She captured an unknown field, and in a sense it was a kind of gamble, but she was right. It turned out to be the most important area to be researching at the time.
So take us through sort of the process of what she did in her first discovery, because she got married pretty relatively soon when she started working in this field, didn't she?
She married her supervisor. He had invented a little an instrument called an electrometer, which measures radiation effectively in the air. And so she could use the instrument that he'd invented. And she discovered along the way, she discovered that a particular kind of uranium salt, its crystals that are dug up, it's called pitchblende. She discovered that they were far, far, far more radioactive than they should have been, considering the amount of uranium they contained. And she decided to pursue this mystery and work out why it was that this particular salt had such a high radioactive effect.
What does pitchblende look like? I mean, I'm always amazed when people talk about the research work, is, oh, we found some pitchblende. Like, how would you know to look there? Like, and what is it?
If you look it up on Google, it looks like a sort of very dark, shiny crystal. Pitchblende is a German word. It's called pitch because it's black, and blenden because it deceives. Nobody knows exactly what metals are inside. It actually contains a very large proportion of different minerals. And what she did was to take tons and tons and tons of this stuff, smash it up, boil it, distill it, get all the other stuff out of it. And the proportion was amazing. It's something like she started off with 2 tons of pitchblende and ended up with 1/10 of a gram of radium chloride. I mean, the physical work involved in that was colossal.
Just where are we here? And like, did she have like a massive warehouse for this? Or like, how does one get 2 tons of pitchblende? Because she's in Paris. Still, isn't she?
She was in Paris. She was working in a small laboratory that was on the outside of the university. It was sort of like a large shed leaning up against the wall that had a leaking roof, and nobody else wanted to work there because by laboratory standards, it was a complete and utter slum. But they hadn't got any money, and nobody was backing them. This was the only place that they could find to work. And they spent 2 years sieving all their pitchblende until they got a little tube of radium chloride.
So this is her and Pierre, her husband.
Yes. And so radium chloride, I've never actually seen it, but when it's in a test tube, it glows green. So that's another part of the romance, to think that you've got this tons and tons of black mineral and you've got this dark, leaky shed. And then in the middle of it, you've got this tiny test tube of radium chloride, which is green. And there's this strange, eerie radiation coming out of the test tube and glowing all over the inside of the shed. It must have been a magic moment when they first got it.
We'll be back after this short break.
On American History Hit, we ride the wild Oregon Trail, delve deep beneath Central Park, and fight the forgotten war of 1812. Join me, Don Wildman, and my expert guests as we uncover the stories that have shaped America in all its endless complexity. We'll follow John Wilkes Booth as he shoots President Lincoln and goes on the run. And we'll walk under the stars with Harriet Tubman as she finds her way to freedom. Follow America's story from the first Native people to footprints on the moon. On American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, with new episodes every Monday and Thursday. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, if you go on Amazon now, I don't think you'd be able to get 2 tons of Pitch Blend delivered. Maybe you could on Amazon Prime, maybe like 2 tons of Pitch Blend. But I'm just trying to imagine all this stuff arriving in their shed. And you know, you're really it not just doing something that's never been done before, but a new physics that has never been thought before, understanding the nucleus of an atom, which has never really been understood before, and the sort of process of going from 2 tons of Pitch Blend to a test tube of green luminous stuff. I mean, that's just, I mean, it sounds pretty crazy.
You talked cheerfully about the concept of a nucleus. I mean, there were a lot of people at that stage who didn't even believe that there was a nucleus. There was the prevalent model of the apple, of the atom, was what's called the plum pudding model. It's the idea that it was sort of like a big Christmas pudding with currants sort of stuffed into it so that it was solid. And what, after Marie Curie's experiments and all the other developments that were taking place in physics, people like Niels Bohr and Einstein, it became clear that a lot of an atom is actually empty space with a tiny little nucleus and even tinier electrons revolving around the nucleus, but rather like the solar system, an awful lot of emptiness.
This is the problem with modern physics. It's really hard to imagine it because our imaginations, we have sort of evolved to think of Newtonian physics, really, and orbiting solar systems we can get our heads around, but it's not like that. Plum puddings we can get our heads around, but it's not like that either.
It's not like that. I imagine she probably thought, most people at the beginning anyway, certainly at the beginning of the century, thought pretty much in terms of solar systems. I mean, I think they did until the middle of the 20th century. I mean, to bend your head around waves of probability is really, really hard. It's much easier to think about little electrons zapping around like planets.
It's fascinating. So we're in her leaky shed, surrounded by lots of crushed Pitch Blend, and in her hand is a file, a test tube of a glowing green substance, magical, that looks like something from Harry Potter. What was it? What did she think it was? And were they excited? And did they shout Eureka? And what was the...
Oh, of course. They were colossally, colossally excited. I mean, this was a stunning, stunning discovery. And it was obvious that immediately, that because it gave off such a powerful radiation, it had very powerful medical activities, and immediately it was taken over by the medical industry. So it's quite ironic that, as well, that this woman who famously didn't care what she wore and wasn't interested in fashion spawned a whole new cosmetic industry, because pretty soon commercial organizations would say, well, you can have toothpaste that'll make your teeth glow nice and white in the dark, and you can put it on your face, it'll improve, you'll have a sparkling complexion.
So this is uranium salts in this test tube, is that what we're talking
about? No, what's in the test tube is radium chloride.
Radium chloride,
it's a salt of radium, and what she went on to do later was isolate crystals of radium. And she discovered two radioactive elements inside the Pitch Blend. One was called radium, but the first one she discovered, she called polonium, and she called it polonium after her native Poland. And although she never managed to isolate it, that was the first radioactive element that she discovered, and the second one was radium.
I mean, you discover something like that. Did she understand what was going on? Did she understand how it worked?
Not in the way that we do now, because there was a whole load of other physics that hadn't yet been invented. So in that sense, no, she didn't understand, but she knew it was radium chloride, and she knew that it was radioactive, and she knew that there was another element called polonium. So in that sense, she knew what was going on, but only within the limits of the physics of the time.
Yeah. You mentioned, I'm going to sort of come on to talk about Nobel Prizes and such, but you mentioned the medical industry sort of seized on this. How did they know? How do you go from, gosh, we found some element with magical properties we don't really understand, but it glows, through to gosh, this is going to have medical implications?
Well, I think while they were working on it, they realised very quickly that they had to be careful that their fingers would become burnt if they handled the radiation. So then it's an obvious right. next stop. If the radiation can burn the skin off my finger, perhaps it can burn the cancer out of my body. But there was a lot of experimentation, and both Pierre and Marie Curie suffered from illnesses that were caused by excess exposure to radiation. Her notebooks in the Sorbonne, her laboratory notebooks, have been locked away for 150 years because they're so packed with radioactivity, and that nobody can look at them for another 150 years until they've lost it all.
But presumably she wouldn't have known that. She may have felt, well, it gives off heat or it burns, but this idea of radioactive decay and all that entails, she wouldn't have been aware of that, would she? And the health hazards.
Well, she could work out about radioactive decay, but what she wasn't aware of is how drastically it was affecting her own body. And the same is true with Pierre. And Pierre was chronically ill, and he was killed in a street accident. But it seems quite likely that he was already rather ill when that happened, and so he might not have been sort of fully aware when he was crossing the street exactly what he was doing when he was knocked down.
It's really interesting, actually. Gosh, it's funny because I'm just looking at an advert here, and it's for an advert called Undark radium luminous material. So this is, they would use it on clocks, for example, on the hands of clocks, so you could see things in the dark, and switches. And I think famously there were the women who would paint the dials of aircrafts, and they would lick the brushes and dip it into the.
No, I did that when I was about four. When I was about four, I had a Walt Disney wristwatch that glowed in the dark, and I absolutely loved it. And so I was wearing this little radioactive watch on my wrist, but the women who made that radioactive watch were putting themselves even more at risk, exactly as you say, by licking the paintbrush, and they all got cancers around their mouth. But also when I was little, the big treat of going to a shoe shop was you could stand in a special machine, an X-ray machine.
I love that machine. I remember that machine.
Yeah, you could look down and see, you could see all your bones wiggling. It was wonderful. Thank goodness they've been banned now. It was really, you know, as children, we were exposed to radiation.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember that, I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole. Do you remember those little mercury puzzles? You had a little maze and you had a little blob of mercury and you'd always open it up and poke the mercury and fiddle around.
Yeah, and you played with mercury at school and sort of rolled it around the table. It's it's terrific fun.
Good times.
Surprising we're still walking.
I know. And look at us, Patricia, we're still here.
Look at us. Think how much better we would have been if we hadn't been wiggling our toes and playing with the mercury.
So suddenly, I guess there was a kind of public consciousness of this wonder material, this magical material. Nobody would have known quite how terrible it was. Just tell us about the Nobel. She won two Nobel Prizes. Did she get one for polonium and one for radium? Or what was the process?
She got the first one. The first one was actually a joint prize with Pierre Curie and Henri Becquerel. And initially, it was going to be awarded just to Pierre Curie and to Henri Becquerel. And a member of the Stockholm Committee of the Nobel Prize said, no, this is appalling. We've got to put Marie Curie in as well. And so eventually it was shared between the three of them. And then after he died, she got another Nobel Prize on her own. For many, many years, she was the only person to win two Nobel Prizes.
How was she thought about in her own lifetime? Firstly, amongst the scientific community, and then presumably she was making a name for herself. And she, I mean, you know, you talked about her, you know, living in a garret and not eating properly and wearing daddy clothes, but she had three great loves in her life, didn't she? She, you know, the husband that we talked about, but also others.
Yes, she fell very much in love with someone who later became a Polish mathematician. When she was just a teenager, she went to work as a governess and in an aristocratic family, and she fell in love with this son of the family. I mean, this is another fairy story. She fell in love with the son of the family and the parents wouldn't let them marry. And she went away and was terribly depressed and was ill for a couple of years. And he apparently loved her until the end of his life. That's the story. But the main true love of her life was Pierre Curie. And that, but then after he died in a road accident, she had an affair with one of his friends called Pierre Langevin. And when that was discovered, she really was hounded by the press because she was seen as being an outsider, as being a foreigner. And the headlines were accusing her of basically being an immigrant who was destroying a stable French family. The man, Langevin, was still married to somebody else and he had children. So in a way, he was far more guilty than her of immoral behaviour, but it was her who got lambasted by the press. And this was the time of the Dreyfus affair, so she was lambasted as being Jewish, which she wasn't. The headlines called her a Jewish whore who, you know, coming over to our country and doing our science and taking our men. I mean, it was really, really horrible stuff.
In terms of the science, in terms of her discovery of polonium and radium and really understanding radioactivity, just maybe paint a picture of just how fundamental that knowledge was going forward in the 20th century and beyond.
Oh, radioactivity completely altered the whole of the rest of the science. The idea that an atom can be broken into little bits was absolutely new. And we wouldn't have had nuclear energy, we wouldn't have had the bomb, all the other little particles that have been discovered, like electrons and mesons and baryons and all the rest of them that sort of make up the groundwork of physics. This was right at the very beginning of all that. That whole field of atomic physics, of nuclear physics, just hadn't been invented. So she was absolutely crucial for funding that.
You talked right at the beginning, you sort of talked about all these different facets of her life, the way that she's portrayed in the media, the way she's thought about, the fact that people think about the cancer charity and this and these sorts of things. And I'm interested how you'd like her to be remembered. If you could wave a magic wand and change everything, how should we remember Marie Curie?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Well, I think primarily I would like her to be remembered for the science that she did. But also, she's an indication of a woman. She's like any other woman or like any other man. She had failings and she had strengths, and she was a human being who happened to carry out a lot of very, very high-powered science. But I think we can also, we have the right to sort of evaluate what she did just as much as any other woman who's in the public press. So I think now I would personally, I'm not sure if this is a very commendable aspect of her personality, but she took enormous interest in her children's education. And although she was quite often an absent mother, she, for 2 years, she ran a homeschooling project with all her friends. So there was a little group of children in the middle of Paris who were being taught by the highest academics in the French university. So that, and she always retained a huge fondness for everything Polish. She insisted that her children spoke Polish. She went home back regularly to Warsaw. When she went to America, she went to America twice. And the first time she raised the money, she went on an absolutely grueling trip to raise money for a radium institute in Paris. And then a few years later, when she was very, very frail and very ill, she went back to America and she did it all over again to raise money for the institute in Warsaw. So she was a very modest, unassuming person who did basically was trying to do the best she could in the world. And it's not always easy.
No. When did she die? I'm interested in how much of her knowledge would have been she would have seen over the 20th century.
Yeah, she died in 1936. And her husband, Pierre, was buried in the Pantheon in Paris. And she was buried outside. And it was only in 1995 that the French agreed that this foreign woman could be interred in their cemetery, the tribute to the great people of France. And it's always very annoying. If you go to Poland, to Warsaw, there's lots of streets and railway stations, banknotes and things named after her. In France, she's still seen as Pierre Curie's wife. So in answer to how would I like her to be recognised, I'd like her to be recognised as an independent person, as Marie Sklodowska Curie, as she wanted to be remembered herself. And someone, yes, who did have a husband, and she worked with a husband and they had different roles. But she's a very, very important independent woman in her own right, with her failings and also her more laudatory aspects.
I love talking to you, Patricia. I really do. Thank you so much for coming on again. Will you come on again and again? Honestly, I just, you will think of something else. It's great having you. I just love.
Okay, that's nice of you to say. So, I mean, I enjoyed doing it too. You do ask some difficult questions.
Do I? I get really interested in things like, you know, when you say, for example, Henri Dudar, who discovered...
Henri Becquerel, who discovered the radiation of the uranium salts, yeah.
All I had in my mind was bechamel, because I'd been doing some cooking, so not bechamel. So, but, you know, you said, okay, well, he had some uranium salts and they were kind of wrapped up and he had an iron cross on it and lo and behold, the picture of the... Was that just by accident he had that? It just sounds... It's almost like... Oh, we had a Petri dish and then there was some penicillin in it and lo and behold, we discovered penicillin. It was too good a story for it to be true.
It is too good a story. He had thought about it in advance and it's the same with Röntgen. I mean, he was looking for it. But there's a famous saying by, it's Claude Bernard, so that something like chance favours the prepared mind. So yes, the bacteria have to float... onto the Petri dish, but you have to be prepared to pick it up. And that's another myth, is that Alexander Fleming didn't do anything about it. I mean, years went by and he never researched into penicillin, and that's why it had to wait for Chain and Flory in the Second World War. So, I mean, that's a story about how wonderful everything British is, because, of course, Alexander Fleming was Scottish, so in Britain we have to celebrate him. And actually, there's probably loads of Petri dishes all over the country that nobody done anything about.
You make the point. Well, we love stories. Humans love stories. And this is it. The history of science is littered with stories like these, which are probably a little bit massaged and a little bit over-dramatized, because that's how we like to consume stories. And I think Marie Curie kind of fits into that box, starving in her garret. She had these great loves of her life. She revolutionized physics. She was an outsider. All these things kind of... I tell you what, I was watching Lawrence of Arabia. And again, the reason we like Lawrence of Arabia is because he fits into all of those boxes. And it's overly romanticized and there's probably elements of truth, but that's not what we're interested in. We love the hero's journey. We love the idea of solving riddles, solving myths, solving puzzles as an outsider against the odds.
So I'll tell you an anti-romantic story. In the early 19th century, there's a man called Semmelweis, and he went into a hospital ward and he carried out an experiment that when doctors came from the operating theatre, before they walked into the maternity ward to deliver a baby, they had to wash their hands and dip them in some alcohol. And that the neonatal and maternal death rates in the maternity ward absolutely plummeted because of that basic act of hygiene. And nobody took any notice for about 30 years. Nothing happened. So that's the sort of opposite of the serendipity story. He was out there saying, wash your hands, and nobody was listening.
Yeah. All right, listen, we'll let you go. Go and do some more beautiful writing on whatever. What are you working on at the moment? You always do fascinating stuff.
Oh, well, I've just written something about Frankenstein and AI. So that's the latest thing I'm thinking about. You know, that AI is going to take over the world just like Frankenstein's creature.
There is. I think there needs to be a new law. Like, the longer two people are involved in conversation, the likelihood of the conversation turning to ChatGPT heightens over time. We need some kind of graph to...
So you see, that's what AI is doing. They're already there invading us. They've already got us. It's not in the future.
Yeah. The good news is ChatGPT will not replace you, Patricia, because you're too good a writer. You're too good. Thanks very much. We'll see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Patricia. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, you know what to do. Don't forget to tell all your friends. And don't forget to hit like and subscribe and do all the other things that the algorithms like. And, of course, as ever, if you've got a suggestion, a spark of inspiration, a theme, an idea you'd like us to cover, you can email us at patented@historyhit.com. Thank you very much for your company. I will see you next time. While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code PATENTED at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's PATENTED for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.